Union President Joe Gamali fiercely defends those accused of using excessive force, even as repeat offenders erode public support for law enforcement overall. This story is by Michael Hardy. One morning in late January 2019, Regina Nicholas texted a prayer to her mother, Joanne Nicholas, just as she did every day. A widow in her 80s, Joanne could no longer make the four-hour drive from Natchitoches, Louisiana to visit her daughter and her son-in-law, Dennis Tuttle, at their bungalow in the Pecan Park neighborhood of southeast Houston. But the family remained close, texting and speaking on the phone regularly. Regina, 58, worked as a bookkeeper among other jobs. That afternoon, on January 28, she called Joanne to warn her against venturing outside in the icy weather gripping central Louisiana. Then she said goodbye, telling her mother that she and Tuttle were going to take a nap. Less than an hour later, 11 armed Houston Police Department officers broke down the door of 7815 Harding Street and killed Regina, Tuttle, and their dog in a fusillade of bullets. Autopsies would reveal that police shot Regina 3 times and Tuttle 9 times. 4 officers were also shot, allegedly by Tuttle, a 59-year-old disabled Navy veteran. At a press conference that evening, Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo said that a neighbor had tipped off officers that heroin was being sold at the Harding Street home, leading a judge to issue a search warrant. Then Joe Gamaldi, the 37-year-old president of the Houston Police Officers Union, stepped up to the microphones. A native of Long Island who started his career in the New York Police Department, Gamaldi has a slender build and short stature. His former NYPD partner affectionately calls him a good little man that belie his street fighter instincts. And on this night, with 4 of his officers in the hospital, he was ready for a brawl. "We are sick and tired of having dirtbags trying to take our lives," Gamaldi announced in his reedy New York accent, jabbing his forefinger at the assembled reporters. "And if you're the ones that are out there spreading the rhetoric that police officers are the enemy, well, just know, we've all got your number now." Gamaldi, the deadly Harding Street raid was the latest skirmish in what he considers a war on cops being waged by a panoply of sinister left-wing groups. Nicholas and Tuttle weren't heroin dealers. There was no heroin. The warrant was based on false information, and a narcotics officer who led the Harding Street raid has since been charged with 2 counts of murder. The couple's families believe, based on an independent evaluation of the crime scene by a forensic investigator, the State Commission, that the injured officers were hit by friendly fire. Those relatives have filed a petition asking the City of Houston to turn over ballistics evidence from the raid. In the aftermath of that Monday's events, the prayer Nicholas texted her mother in the morning seems especially bittersweet. It began, "Dear Lord, thank you for a new day and week ahead that is full of promise and possibilities." I first met Joe Gamaldi this past July at a Tony Juice Bar in Houston's Montrose neighborhood. COVID-19 cases were approaching a summer peak in Texas, and we were the only customers there. Gamaldi wore a floral patterned dress shirt tucked into neatly pressed rose-colored khakis that ended at his ankles, revealing a pair of monk-strap loafers. His close-cropped black hair and tortoiseshell glasses make him appear more like the CEO of a tech startup than a cop. Before we met, he told me to look for the nerdy-looking guy with glasses. After we'd taken off our masks to drink iced coffees, I asked Gamaldi if he regretted his inflammatory statement about the Harding Street raid. "In that moment, we had 4 police officers shot, one of which will never walk again," he said. "Obviously, after the fact, we learned that the warrant was falsified. But the other people on that team didn't know that. The officer who was paralyzed, he didn't know that at the time. I probably should have been more careful with my words and really drilled down on what I was trying to say. But, you know, I'm an emotional guy, and in that moment I was upset and angry, and I spoke from the heart." What about linking Nicholas and Tuttle, who had no known connection to any activist groups, to law enforcement critics? Gamaldi responded that the constant drumbeat of anti-police rhetoric created an atmosphere in which those who may already be on the edge decide to shoot police officers. "All you hear from people in the media and politicians is that we're out there murdering people, that we're the worst people in the world, then people who are already at that point may take that additional step." Gamaldi's full-throated support of the police and his equally full-throated denunciation of the groups he believes are anti-police has recently thrust him into the national spotlight. In August 2019, 8 months after the Harding Street raid, he was elected National Vice President of the Fraternal Order of Police, the country's largest police union, which endorsed President Trump in 2016 and 2020. He has visited the Trump White House twice and is a regular guest on Fox News and other conservative media outlets. But since being sworn in as HPOU President in January 2018, Gamaldi has made at least as many enemies as friends. Anise Parker, Houston's mayor from 2010 to 2016, describes him as a bomb thrower. I don't know whether that helps him with the rank and file, but it certainly doesn't help him with the mayor or city council, she told me, and I don't know that it helps him with the majority of the public. Harris County Commissioner Adrian Garcia, formerly a sheriff, a Houston City Council member, and a 23-year veteran of the Houston Police Department, expressed similar unease about Grimaldi's Manichaean rhetoric. It's important that a union leader exercise the same tactics that you would ask a patrolman to exercise out on the streets, Garcia said. If you come across domestic violence, you don't say and do things to incite the situation. You come in as a calming force. The ultimate test of a union leader's effectiveness is how he or she handles contract negotiations. In 2018, Grimaldi led the talks for the HPOU's current 2-year contract, which was quickly and unanimously passed by the Houston City Council, even though the deal included provisions that critics say make it almost impossible to hold police officers accountable for misconduct. That contract expires in December, but the road to a new one has become significantly bumpier thanks to emboldened local activists pushing for fundamental reforms. In June, more than 100 Houstonians called into an 8-hour virtual city council meeting, committee meeting on the topic of police reform, many of them demanding that the council defund or abolish the police department. In September, a task force convened by Sylvester Turner, Houston's mayor, released a report on police reform that included a long list of recommendations. The public is always ahead of the politicians, said Ron DeLord, a union lawyer who led the Combined Law Enforcement Associations of Texas for 30 years. Otherwise, women wouldn't have gotten a vote. American Indians wouldn't have gotten citizenship. Gay rights, gay marriage, marijuana. Public attitude starts changing, it builds up steam, and there's a tipping point. And that tipping point for police is George Floyd. There are several obstacles to police reform. Training that teaches officers to constantly fear for their lives. District attorneys reluctant to indict the cops they work with every day, qualified immunity protection that makes it almost impossible to successfully sue officers, but perhaps the greatest barrier and one likely least understood by the general public is the political power of police unions, which represent a majority of the country's approximately 800,000 law enforcement officers. The detailed contracts that each union negotiates with its local city or county govern almost every aspect of a police officer's job, from clothing allowances and fitness requirements to salaries and benefits. They also generally lay out a disciplinary appeal process that gives officers the opportunity to challenge and, in many cases, overturn sanctions for misconduct. Written in opaque legalese, union contracts are, at least in the short term, impervious to protest marches, unmoved by public opinion, and indifferent to presidential elections. Contracts live in the realm of the law, not in the hothouse atmosphere of social media. Often negotiated behind closed doors and ratified by city council members elected with the help of campaign contributions and volunteer work by union members, contracts protect cops from activists, politicians, and even police chiefs, who, as political appointees, often find themselves in conflict with unions. Perhaps most significantly, as the nation has discovered in recent years, these contracts often protect police who use excessive force from the consequences of their actions. Police refer to themselves as the thin blue line protecting society from anarchy, but there's another blue line, the one protecting police from accountability. In Houston, that line is being held by Joe Grimaldi. Grimaldi grew up in the middle-class suburban neighborhood on Long Island, where the value of unions was impressed upon him by his grandfather, an Italian immigrant, brick mason, whose union salary eventually allowed him to purchase 2 homes in New York and Florida. After earning a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from the University of Hartford, Grimaldi joined NYPD in 2005 at the age of 22. Like nearly all new New York Police Department officers at the time, Grimaldi was assigned to foot patrol straight out of the police academy, in his case in East New York, a neighborhood in Brooklyn that has long had one of the highest crime rates in the city. When Grimaldi showed up at his precinct on his first day, his supervisor handed him a map, pointed out the 2 blocks he was responsible for. "I walked, I think, 3 miles out to my post," Grimaldi recalled. "People are just like, welcome to the neighborhood, rookie. They're throwing things off the buildings at you, batteries, eggs, all type of stuff. It was definitely a trial by fire." After 6 months of foot patrol, Grimaldi stayed in East New York and was assigned his first partner, Dave Siciliano, a 3-year veteran whom Grimaldi credits with teaching him how to be a cop. They spent their time driving the streets in a patrol car, responding to one call after another. Assaults, shootings, robberies in progress, stolen vehicles. "I can't imagine anywhere tougher to patrol straight out of the gate," Siciliano told me. "It's hard going from suburban life to the heart of inner city violence. It's difficult to describe that shell shock." The NYPD's relationship with the East New York community was tense. more police interactions you have, the less community trust you're going to have. And when you have violence, you're going to have police interactions, whether warranted or unwarranted, Siciliano said. On September 2nd, 2007, Siciliano and Gamaldi responded to a call about a man named Audie Wilson who had allegedly pointed a gun at a fellow spectator during a soccer match. Arriving on the scene as the crowd was exiting the stadium, the officers met the caller who pointed them to Wilson. According to Gamaldi, Wilson pulled a gun and stuck it in Siciliano's stomach. I tackled him and we're on the ground, Gamaldi said. Everybody's screaming at us because we've tackled a man in the middle of all this. We get him into custody, we recover the gun, and we have to get him out of the crowd as quickly as possible because obviously the crowd's turning on us. Neither Wilson nor his lawyer could be reached for this story. Wilson alleged in a 2010 lawsuit that the two officers brutally attacked him from behind without probable cause and called him the N-word. After Wilson's lawyer repeatedly failed to show up in court, the lawsuit was withdrawn. Wilson also filed complaints against Gamaldi and Siciliano with New York Civilian Complaint Review Board, alleging force and abuse of authority. The CCRB ruled one of Wilson's complaints unsubstantiated, which, according to the board's website, means the available evidence is insufficient to determine whether the officer did or did not commit misconduct. Another complaint was declared exonerated, meaning the officer was found to have committed the act alleged, but the officer's actions were determined to be lawful. The NYPD later gave Gamaldi an award for his actions that day. Being sued by Wilson left Gamaldi with a jaundiced view of civilian complaints. He was saying that we did all these horrible things, that we said all these horrible things, Gamaldi told me, his incredulity undimmed by the decade that has passed since the lawsuit. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. He and his partner did absolutely nothing wrong, and they definitely did not use the N-word, Gamaldi maintained. His conclusion, people put things in complaints like that because they're trying to get money out of them. The incident also gave him a deeper appreciation for police unions. Gamaldi and Siciliano were defended against the CCRB complaints by the New York City Police Benevolent Association and against Wilson's civil suit by New York City's legal department. Partly out of frustration with Wilson's CCRB complaint, Gamaldi transferred to the Houston Police Department in 2008 when he was 24. He was also tired, he said, of living in a three-bedroom apartment just outside Queens that he shared with two firefighters. A visit to his brother, United Airlines executive based in Houston at the time, sealed the deal. I was like, you're kidding? You can have a home for $150,000 or $200,000? I'm in. At the HPD Academy, Gamaldi met his future wife, Alexa, a fellow officer with whom he now has two daughters. He bought a house in the suburbs, and he met Ray Hunt, then the vice president of the Houston Police Officers Union, who would become a mentor and father figure to Gamaldi. The two first crossed paths when Hunt gave a presentation to the police academy. When the cadets were encouraged to contribute $5 a month to the HPOU's Political Action Committee, which supports union-friendly candidates, Gamaldi raised his hand and asked if he could donate more. I was like, dude, what's your name? Hunt recalled. A few years later, when a position opened up on the HPOU board, Hunt immediately thought of the eager young officer from his presentation. Gamaldi was then patrolling Acres Homes, a predominantly black neighborhood in northwest Houston. He was exactly what we needed, Hunt told me, a young officer who got what we do here at HPOU. Gamaldi's fellow cadets had long joked that he was destined to be a union leader, given his preoccupation with officers' rights. They wanted us to stay late, I'd be like, hey, we've got to get overtime for that, he said. After spending 2 years on the HPOU board, Gamaldi was elected second vice president in 2013, the same year Hunt became president. When Hunt announced in 2017 that he wouldn't run again, Gamaldi, just 34, was elected to the presidency with 91% of the vote. As president, he moved quickly to overhaul the union's public relations operation to better jump in front of negative news stories. In 2018, Jose Gomez, the 41-year-old owner of a local moving company, sued three HPD officers for assaulting him during a traffic stop. Gamaldi responded by going on local news to claim that Gomez had been resisting arrest and that the officers had acted appropriately. In the past, these cases would be handled with an answer of, we can't comment because litigation is ongoing, Gamaldi explained. In the June 2018 issue of Badge and Gun, the HPOU's monthly newsletter, but I believe in defending officers and not allowing them to get dragged through the mud. The criminal charge against Gomez for resisting arrest was eventually dropped. His lawsuit is awaiting trial. Gamaldi had already taken charge of the union's social media accounts, which regularly lobbed salvos against criminal suspects whom he described as dirtbags, miscreants, and cowards. 2018, he campaigned vigorously against Proposition B, a Houston ballot referendum guaranteeing equal pay for police officers and firefighters of the same rank. According to Mayor Turner, the measure would have blown a hole in the city's budget and forced it to lay off workers, including police officers. When Prop B passed nearly 60% of the vote, then the HPOU joined the city of Houston in successfully suing to overturn it for violating state law and collective bargaining. An overwhelming number of voters in the city of Houston voted for the proposition, said Patrick Marty Lankin, president of the Houston Professional Firefighters Association, who noted that firefighters have had only a single 1% pay raise since 2013. For HPOU and the mayor to be operating in tandem after putting millions of dollars into a campaign that they lost was just flabbergasting to our firefighters and their families. 3 days after George Floyd was killed by police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis on May 25, 2020, sparking nationwide protests, Gamaldi issued a statement to union members via Twitter. Without mentioning Floyd by name, he advised officers to avoid a similar incident. If a fellow officer on your scene is doing something that you believe is wrong, from what you see and feel, you have an obligation and duty to step up and speak up. But as millions of Americans continued demonstrating for racial justice across the country, including at a massive march in Houston on June 2nd, the tone of Gamaldi's social media post veered into the apocalyptic, decrying extreme violence against officers after two cops were shot in New York City one night in June. This turn from initially condemning incidents of police brutality to lambasting protesters is a characteristic move for the union boss. Call it the Gamaldi pivot. It's an effective strategy. Over the summer, as the temperature of Gamaldi's rhetoric rose, so did his visibility. He appeared on the Glenn Beck program, Newsmax, and Fox News to criticize cities such as Minneapolis and Austin for pledging to dismantle, partially defund, or reorganize their police departments. When violence flared in Portland and Seattle later in the summer, Gamaldi went on Fox and Friends to assail the cities for not cracking down harder on the police critics. The governments in Portland and Seattle are frankly implicit in this right now, he said, his voice rising in indignation. They've allowed Antifa terrorists, and that's what they are. They're terrorists, okay? They're using violence and fear to influence how people view things, to run wild, all while tying the hands of our police officers. On criminal justice matters, Gamaldi and the White House were in lockstep. He regularly praises Trump on social media. On July 15, he met with Vice President Mike Pence at the White House to discuss the ongoing protests and the state of law enforcement. Gamaldi's unwavering support for Trump has earned him the nickname Mini MAGA from Black Lives Matter Houston co-founder Ashton Woods. He's the Vice President of the Fraternal Order of Police, Woods told me. You know what that looks like, and you know who they support. Gamaldi believes he has little choice but to line up behind Trump, given that he perceives as a lack of appreciation for police from Democratic politicians. Law enforcement officers are desperate for people to support them because we feel like we're being attacked by everyone, he said. And here you have the most important person in the world saying that he supports law enforcement. But Trump has a long history of encouraging the kind of police brutality that Gamaldi says he opposes. During a 2016 rally, the then-presidential candidate lamented that security guards weren't able to use sufficient violence against protesters. In 2017, he appeared to instruct an audience of Long Island police officers to be harsher with suspects. When you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just seen them thrown in rough. I said, please don't be too nice, Trump told the laughing cops. When I brought up the latter statement, Gamaldi grimaced. When you say things like that, I'm sure it was probably off the cuff, but it's not helpful, he allowed. Several national law enforcement groups criticized Trump's comments, but not the Fraternal Order of Police, which issued a statement suggesting that the president hadn't intended for his words to be taken literally. His support for Trump hasn't prevented Gamaldi from aligning himself with Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner, a Democrat. The HPOU endorsed Turner in both his 2015 and 2019 campaigns. Gamaldi told me that Turner was a huge supporter of the police and probably the best mayor we've ever had in Houston. Their synergy has continued to pay dividends for the union. In June, while cities across the country were slashing police funding, Turner successfully pushed through an annual budget that included a $19 million increase for the HPD. Despite the votes taking place the day after George Floyd was buried in the Houston suburb of Pearland, the budget passed unanimously in the city council. An attempt by Councilmember Letitia Plummer to redirect $11.7 million from the police failed to gain any support. Plummer ultimately voted for the budget anyway, explaining that there were a lot of really good programs that the city was funding. Gamaldi works out of a spacious utilitarian office on the third floor of HPOU headquarters, an inconspicuous commercial building near downtown Houston. Tacked to a bulletin board next to his desk is a quote from Theodore Roosevelt's Man in the Arena speech. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or whether doer of deeds could have done them better. In early September, I met Grimaldi at his office to discuss contract negotiations, which had been repeatedly delayed by COVID-19 and the nationwide protest against police brutality. I asked how Houstonians could have confidence in a fair contract when the mayor and 13 out of 16 members of the city council have accepted donations from the HPOU's political action committee. In June, Austin's mayor and every member of city council took a pledge not to accept union donations. Grimaldi replied that the HPOU doesn't get everything it wants. What didn't the union get in the 2018 contract, I asked. I mean, obviously, we wanted more money, Grimaldi replied, leaning back in his chair and chuckling. I pressed him. What about the appeals process, the protections for officers accused of excessive force? Are there things you want to strengthen? No, he answered. I believe our system is fair. It's fair to the city. It's fair to the department. It's fair to our officers. So there wasn't anything that we were asking for in that last contract as far as discipline was concerned, like greater rights or anything like that. The HPOU's current contract is 102 pages and contains a number of provisions seemingly designed to frustrate effective oversight. Officers accused of misconduct, for instance, are granted a 48-hour window before answering questions from an internal affairs investigator. During those 2 days, the accused officer must be given access to both the original complaint and written statements from witnesses, officers, and supervisors. Critics of the police contend that this arrangement gives officers who have access to union-provided lawyers a chance to get their story straight before answering questions under oath. Under the contract, Houston Police Department has just 180 days after an incident of serious misconduct to fire an officer. If the incident is discovered after that period, the department can impose a suspension of no more than 15 days. Similar provisions are common in big city Texas Police Department contracts. Last year in San Antonio, an officer who was fired after giving a homeless man a sandwich filled with dog feces won his appeal because the punishment wasn't handed down within 180 days. Even if an offense is addressed within that period, Houston officers can appeal the internal disciplinary action to either a civil service commission composed of members appointed by the mayor, or in the case of more serious punishments, an independent hearing examiner. The examiner for each appeal is chosen randomly from a pool of 12 professional arbitrators, half of them selected by the city and half by the union. Because the arbitrator can only sustain, reduce, or overturn the punishment, officers have nothing to lose by appealing and much to gain. Between 2007 and 2012, the Texas Observer reported, arbitrators reduced officer punishment in half of all cases and overturned it completely in about 1 out of 6. Arbitrators must be reappointed every 2 years, so they may have a vested interest in finding a compromise between the department and the officer. Grimaldi and other union advocates argue that such protections provide due process to officers accused of misconduct, but in practice they ensure that officers are rarely disciplined. A Houston Chronicle investigation found that between 2008 and 2012, HPD's Internal Affairs Division reviewed 636 shootings by its officers and concluded that only one lacked justification. A case involving an officer whose unholstered gun accidentally fired as he was trying to arrest a suspect. The political clout of police unions makes reforming their contracts extremely difficult, but not impossible. In 2017, the Austin City Council unanimously voted down the contract that the local union was negotiated with Mayor Steve Adler, sending both parties back to the bargaining table. The vote followed a determined 18-month campaign led by the Austin Justice Coalition and inspired by the police killing of a teenager named David Joseph and by the brutal arrest of a 26-year-old Austin schoolteacher, Brayon King, during a 2015 traffic stop. Austin Police Department Officer Brian Richter had dragged King out of her vehicle and slammed her face down onto the asphalt, yet he received only a reprimand for the incident. When video of the arrest leaked to the press a year later, Art Acevedo, at the time the Austin police chief, publicly apologized to King, but couldn't impose additional punishment on Richter because of the union contract's 180-day rule. We knew, for that reason alone, we needed to go and try to work on that in the contract itself, recalled Suki McMahon, the strategy director of the AJC board. Unlike in Houston, contract negotiations in Austin are open to the public, and when weekly talks began in May 2017 between the city and the union, the AJC made sure they had representatives in the room. We couldn't talk, but we could take notes and then disseminate the information back to the community to let them know this is awful, this is bullshit, Chaz Moore, the founder and executive director of AJC, told me. When the final contract ended up including just one of the many reforms the AJC had sought, an online civilian complaint system, the group launched a public information campaign to discredit the contract, hosting community forums in the districts of every council member. We built this super huge coalition, a little bit of everybody, Moore said. We had the environmentalists, we had the healthcare folks, people who love dogs, people who love babies, people who love bikes. Ignoring the union's warning that hundreds of officers would retire if they rejected the contract, the Austin City Council did exactly that late on the night of December 13, 2017. Only 33 officers retired from the force of more than 2,600. With the police union refusing to renegotiate, the old contract expired at the end of the year, and Austin reverted to Chapter 143 of the Texas Local Government Code, which regulates big city police and fire departments without contracts. Union eventually returned to the table in the summer of 2018 with a new chief negotiator who sought out the AJC's input. The final contract relaxed the 180-day rule, prevented short suspensions from being automatically downgraded to written reprimands, and expanded the responsibilities of the officer of police oversight, which can now independently review citizen complaints, audit footage from dashboard and body-worn cameras, and recommend discipline to the Austin police chief, and published the results of the investigations online. Although it didn't include all the changes the activists had requested, the contract was a major step forward for them, and despite including a 9% pay raise spread over 4 years, the total cost of the salaries and benefits in the contract was $44 million, far less than the original proposal. With the current Houston police contract expiring at the end of 2020, local activists are trying to replicate the success of their Austin counterparts in Houston. However, the talks between the city and the union have always taken place behind closed doors. In July, the ACLU of Texas called on Mayor Turner to open these meetings, arguing that policing is a public service subject to democratic governance. The three Houston City Council members I spoke to, including Greg Travis, a conservative who represents the wealthy section of West Houston, told me they want to be more involved in the negotiations. Take a little quick break here to remind you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight into Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. Now return to our text. Travis, who was on the city council when the current contract was approved in 2018, expressed frustration at being shut out of the talks. No council member had any input on the contract, he said. They come to us for approval. They don't come to us for discussion. In July, City Director of Communications Mary Benton told the Houston Chronicle that contract negotiations will move forward at Mayor Turner's direction and in the city's best interest. Turner declined an interview request for the story. Thanks to the HPOU contract's evergreen clause, if the new contract isn't ratified by the end of 2020, the current contract will be extended indefinitely, with officers receiving an automatic 2% pay raise on July 1st, 2021. But that doesn't mean the union lacks an incentive to negotiate or that activists don't have leverage to demand reforms. At some point, we have to have an agreement in place long-term, Gamali acknowledged. Otherwise, our officers will never get another raise for the rest of their careers. No matter what happens, the current contract negotiations will likely be Gamali's last as Houston's union president. He's publicly announced that he won't run for re-election when his term expires in December 2021. I just wanted to free up a little bit more time for my family, he explained. Gamali said he'll go back to being an ordinary police officer, although one friend suggested that he would be an effective politician, something Gamali pointedly declined to deny when I brought it up. I'm going to continue to be the vice president of the Fraternal Order of Police, and I'm going to continue to be a voice for law enforcement, he said, whether some people like it or they don't. The official police account of the January 2019 Harding Street raid started to unravel almost immediately, as did the angry spin that Gamaldi initially supplied. An internal affairs investigation would eventually reveal that the entire operation had been triggered by a 9/11 call from a neighbor, Patricia Ann Garcia, who claimed to have seen her daughter doing drugs at the Nicholas and Tuttle house. After receiving the 911 report, veteran HPD narcotics officer Gerald Goins secured a no-knock warrant to search the house by telling a judge that one of his confidential informants had purchased heroin there. But there was no informant, and the drug buy never took place. Goins appears to have simply made up these details. After the raid, police found small amounts of cocaine and marijuana, but no heroin. Garcia has been charged by the federal government with one count of false information and hoaxes. The case is awaiting trial. 2 months after the deadly raid, with evidence of their misconduct mounting, Goins and Officer Stephen Bryant, his former partner, abruptly retired from the department and began collecting their pensions. In August 2019, Harris County District Attorney Kim Ogg charged Goins with 2 counts of murder and Bryant with tampering with a government record. The HPOU then stopped paying Goins' legal bills, although it continues to fund Bryant's defense. His case is slightly different from Gerald's, and I'm just going to have to kind of leave it at that, Gimaldi told me. In July, Ogg charged 4 more narcotics officers with lying on police reports and stealing money from the division. The HPOU is also paying for their defense. Gimaldi's rhetoric continues to upset John Nicholas, Regina Nicholas's brother, who volunteers as a fire chief and works part-time as an EMT in Louisiana. He remembers watching a segment on the CBS Evening News that night in January about a deadly raid in Houston. It wasn't until the next morning that he learned that the couple killed in the raid were his sister and brother-in-law. I'm not against police. I work for the Louisiana Department of Public Safety, he told me, but right is right and wrong is wrong. According to family and friends, Regina spent much of her time helping others, driving friends to medical appointments, picking up groceries for housebound neighbors, and caring for Tuttle, who suffers from seizures resulting from a traumatic head injury he received in the Navy. She did everything else before she did herself, John said. Last time he spoke to his sister was when she called him a few weeks before her death on his birthday. He's been frustrated by the slow pace of the criminal cases against Goins and Bryant and by the paucity of information about the raid. More than anything, the family wants to clear the couple's name from Gimaldi's accusations. John still hadn't received an apology. Shoes on the other foot now, he said. They're the scumbags and the dirtbags, the way I look at it. For his part, Gimaldi showed no sign of changing his tactics. In April, HPD officers shot and killed 27-year-old Nicholas Chavez, a father of 3. Police were dispatched to the scene after 911 callers observed Chavez, who had a history of mental illness, wandering through traffic with a piece of rebar, repeatedly stabbing himself. As captured by body-worn cameras, officers soon arrived and spent the next 15 minutes trying to subdue Chavez with stun guns and beanbag rounds before ultimately shooting him to death. Chavez fell to the ground after the first few shots and was shot 21 more times while he was on his knees. Following a 5-month internal investigation, HPD Chief Art Acevedo fired 4 of the officers involved in the shooting, explaining that it wasn't objectively reasonable to fire so many shots at a man who was at his greatest level of incapacitation. At a September press conference, the police chief said, "I cannot defend that, and to anybody that wants to defend it, don't come to this department, because as long as I'm the police chief here, we will not allow people to use deadly force unless it is objectively reasonable, and it just simply isn't." That same day, Gimaldi spoke at a separate press conference held by the HPOU. Visibly upset and appearing to hold back tears, he called the firings deplorable. "This truly was a tragedy," the union boss said, his voice breaking. "But the chief is now spreading that tragedy to 4 other families by unjustly firing these officers and using them as political fodder." According to Gimaldi, Chavez was trying to commit suicide by cop. He believes Chavez's shooting was justified because he pointed a deadly weapon at officers, a taser. But video of the incident showed that the taser had already been fired, rendering it harmless. The 4 officers are appealing their terminations with legal representation from the HPOU. Under the provisions of the union contract, if they win the appeal, they could get their jobs back. For Gimaldi, the firings were simply another example of America's increasingly anti-police climate. Earlier in the summer, he told me that officer morale was the lowest he had ever seen. "The officers that are older, you know, they can retire. They see the light at the end of the tunnel. Me, I'm like middle of the road. I still got another 10 years or so to do." He said he feels the worst for younger officers. They're not going to stay if this continues. It's not unusual for labor unions to defend workers, even at the cost of public image. But I asked Gimaldi if he felt any responsibility for the rising hostility toward police, given his repeated defenses of officers like Goins and Bryant. Gimaldi responded that unions simply ensure officers are given the benefit of the doubt. "Doesn't an officer deserve to have that little bit of protection?" he shot back. "Especially when we live in such a political climate right now, when a chief or sheriff will discipline someone just because." Ron DeLord, the union lawyer who told me George Floyd's killing marked a turning point in American history, said, "A tough reformation lies ahead for the nation's police departments." Rough and plain spoken, DeLord had spent his career promoting and defending police unions, including publishing 3 books on the subject. He was the Austin Police Union's chief negotiator during the recent contract fight. But even Delord acknowledged that police reform was inevitable. "The world's going to change," he said. "I know most of the major police union leaders around the country. I've talked with all of them in Texas. They know it's coming." For all the power police unions have accumulated, Delord believes it will be public opinion that ultimately decides the future of American law enforcement. The police may bitch about it, they may get in a political argument about it, but in the end, if the city of Houston wants less police, they'll have less police. We turn now to the state section. This is News and Politics. It's an analysis by Christopher Hooks in this month's column entitled Wild Alan West. How did a Florida man become the face of the Texas Republican Party, and why is he at war with the governor? On a warm and perfectly pleasant Saturday afternoon of October 10th, Alan West, the newly minted chairman of the Republican Party of Texas, stood on the steps of the government's mansion and loudly condemned one of his party's most high-profile and popular officials, Greg Abbott. Elected in July, West was in part responsible for leading the defense against the liberal blitz, supposedly coming in November, when polls suggested that Democrats had a chance at taking control of the state house, winning several congressional seats, and even flipping Texas to Joe Biden. Abbott also had a role to play with his campaign bank account of some $38 million and better approval ratings than anyone else in the state party, despite dropping 9 points since an April high of 56%. Party chairman and the governor should have been working in tandem. Instead, West was in front of a fired-up crowd at Abbott's home, railing against the tyranny of the governor's efforts to slow the spread of the coronavirus, even though by October, Abbott had eased up on almost all of his executive orders. West was handed a megaphone. A call rang out immediately. "Alan West for governor!" He admonished the speaker with, "Oh, stop it, stop it." But then others in the crowd of about 100 protesters began cheering. Behind him, clapping, was Michael Quinn Sullivan, affectionately known to his enemies as MQS, pronounced Mucus, the conservative activist who has contributed significantly to the Republican Party's past year of discord and dysfunction by releasing a secretly recorded tape of House Speaker Dennis Bonin attempting to direct Sullivan to go after members of Bonin's own Republican flock. Sullivan looked as delighted as West looked more mock bashful. "Paid political announcements by a bunch of knuckleheads," West said. The crowd laughed. West told the story of the motorcycle accident he suffered in May during his campaign for party chairman. After attending a Texas Freedom Rally at the Capitol, one of West's many public appearances in the spring and summer, when he was already blasting the governor's anti-pandemic measures. West was involved in a collision outside Waco and was severely injured. He survived, he told the crowd, thanks to the strength of their prayers. Now that he had recovered, he would be doubly sure never to forget the oath that he had sworn when he joined the U.S. Army to protect the nation from all enemies, foreign and domestic. The implication was probably not lost on this crowd. Abbott is one of those enemies. That kind of rhetoric, of course, is common among some conservative activists and politicians, but there has long been an informal division between the folks who say such things and party leaders who consider themselves the adults in the GOP, and that division has held up through many raucous years. For the past decade, the chairs have been a series of competent, melodrama officials, boring even. There was Steve Munisteri, an astute number cruncher with an impeccable reputation who ran the party from 2010 to 2015. Tom Meckler ruled from 2015 to 2017, warning when he resigned that Republicans should cut down on the anger and backbiting and aspire to look more like Texas by conducting outreach to young and minority voters. Then came James Dickey, an unfailingly amiable fellow whose Twitter bio cites his love of Monty Python movies. The three men shared an understanding that the job of the party chair was to raise a lot of money, keep the trains running on time, and otherwise get out of the way. West has a very different view of his role. At the governor's mansion rally, he told the crowd that the chairman of the Brazos County GOP had asked him recently why in the hell he was lambasting the governor 3 days before the start of early voting. He was protesting the governor, he replied, because he, Alan West, had a clear vision. "Leaders know what right looks like," he explained to his audience. "True leaders don't pick and choose when to do what is right. They do what is right all the time." The message, in other words, is that West would never do what was politically expedient for the party's sake. He would do what Alan West thought was the right thing to do. You could hear that afternoon GOP loyalists grumbling from Dalhart to Donna. Who is this guy looking out for? The story of how Alan West became chairman starts in the August of 2003 when he was a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army stationed in Taji, a village north of Baghdad. West later testified that an intelligence specialist had told him that the local insurgency was targeting him in a plot that involved a police officer named Yahia Hamoudi, who had worked with the Americans in the past. West ordered his soldiers to seize Hammoudi. This could get ugly, told his subordinates, who beat the man as West stood by. When Hammoudi continued to profess his innocence, West took him outside and staged a mock execution in which he fired his pistol near Hamoudi's head. In West's telling, Hammoudi immediately confessed and named names. In Hammoudi's version, he told West what he wanted to hear to save his life. Nothing came of the information Hammoudi gave. Mock executions are a textbook form of torture, a war crime, and are expressly prohibited in the U.S. Army Field Manual. When word of West's action spread, he was relieved of command and nearly court-martialed. What seemed an ignominious end to a military career turned out to be a fine start for a political one. West became a conservative cause celebre overnight, a hero to those who thought America's armies of occupation were being hamstrung by effete bureaucrats and who were eager for evidence that torture worked. Right-wing media personalities raised money for his legal defense. 95 Republican members of Congress signed a letter defending his actions. Instead of facing as much as 11 years in prison, West was assessed a $5,000 fine and went home to Florida to become a high school social studies teacher. West's case remained a subject of debate in the military. To one group, including some enlisted men and women, West's actions marked him as exactly the kind of commanding officer they wanted as they were sidling into blind alleys in Al-Anbar province, the kind who fought war as they thought it should be fought. West had encouraged that image, testifying after the Hammoudi incident that he'd go through hell with a gasoline can to protect his men. To another group, especially officers, West's actions were unforgivable, evidence of a dangerous arrogance. If Hammoudi was innocent, what did West's stunt teach the police officer's friends and family about the Americans? Had West made life harder for the unit to replace his, and indeed for coalition forces in Iraq more generally? Hammoudi told the New York Times in 2004 that he had stopped working with Americans and shuddered at the sights of their Humvees. West had become so fixated upon his own ideas of right and wrong that he'd forgotten his many other obligations to the organization he was a part of and the mission at hand. That's precisely what worries Texas Republicans right now. Substitute the Army for the Republican Party of Texas, enlisted men for the GOP grassroots and officers for GOP grandees and elected officials, and you have the approximate shape of the debate taking place about West's sudden ascendance in Texas. In 2010, riding the Tea Party wave, West was elected to represent Florida's 22nd Congressional District, which ran from Fort Lauderdale north to Palm Beach. He quickly became one of Congress's most controversial members. Ted Nugent and Sarah Palin both suggested him for vice president in 2012. His back catalog of minor and major outrages is too long to list, but is perhaps best summed up by the episode in which he announced without any evidence that there were 78 to 81 members of the Democratic Party that are members of the Communist Party. He served only one term, a victim in part of the Republican legislature of Florida, making his district more Democratic. After he left Congress, he fell back into relative obscurity. With the opportunities drawing up back east, West, like many before him, pulled up stakes and moved to Texas. The state, and especially the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, where West settled, offers fertile ground for minor conservative celebrities, among them Glenn Beck, Tommy Lahren, and Dana Loesch. In 2015, he was given his first formal introduction into the state's internal politics when Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick appointed him to the Texas Sunset Advisory Commission, a sleepy but important bureaucratic backwater that periodically reviews and makes recommendations regarding state agencies. The years passed, he wrote a book about his devotion to his new home entitled Hold Texas, Hold the Nation, Victory or Death. Published in October 2018, it argued that conservatives had to make a sort of last stand in the Lone Star State, defending it from liberal ideologies infiltrating from the outside thanks to the state's rapid population growth, including through immigration. In the election a few weeks later, Democratic fortunes in the state surged dramatically. The next year, West announced his candidacy to run the most important state Republican party in the country. If he won, he would become the first black chairman of a political party in the history of Texas. But he rarely, if ever, mentioned that fact, even during a summer in which debates over racism came to the fore of American life. Though he called for the police officer who killed George Floyd in Minneapolis, a very sick, demented, evil law enforcement officer, he argued that the protest over Floyd's death had been hijacked by anarchists and compared those seeking to take down Confederate statuary to the Taliban. On the campaign trail, West was clearly loved by many conservatives, but that's often not enough of a base to secure a victory. He appeared to have more in common with Jared Woodfill, who ran an abortive campaign for party chair as a far-right insurgent in 2016 under the patronage of right-wing hormone therapy merchant Dr. Steve Hotze, than to previous chairmen such as Munisteri. But Munisteri's party had something that the party of Dickey, West's opponent for GOP chair, didn't. Points on the scoreboard. 2010 to 2015, the Texas GOP steamrolled all comers. Nothing silences critics like success. But in the sole election cycle to take place under Dickey's chairmanship, it was the GOP that did poorly instead. Was that Dickey's fault? No. It was because Trump had damaged the Republican brand and turned off many suburban voters in Texas. The results of 2018 could have been an opportunity for Republican leaders to meditate on why they lost so much ground and adjust their course. The other choice was to double down. Laissez-les bon temps rouler. The party chairman is elected at the Texas GOP's biennial convention. The gathering, billed by the party as the largest political gathering in the free world, had been scheduled for May in Houston, but was postponed until July because of the pandemic. Members of the state Republican Executive Committee desperately wanted to hold the convention in person, in part to show that the fearful wailing about the disease was unnecessary. This was clearly not a good idea, if only for the waves of negative attention that might follow if any of the delegates, many of them elderly, fell ill or died. But the SREC persisted in Zoom meeting after Zoom meeting. One member, Walter West, no relation, a private security consultant and supporter of Allen's from Montgomery County, swung a bottle of screwball peanut butter whiskey at his laptop camera, charging Dickey with incompetence. "Don't drink the Kool-Aid," he beseeched his fellow committee members. He had to be ejected from the meeting by the digital sergeant-at-arms. At the last minute, the party was forced to come up with plans for a digital convention. It was an unmitigated disaster, but set by technical screw-ups and an increasingly angry base. Scheduled for 3 days and finally ended after five, with much of the party's business left undone. If West wasn't leading before, the clown show assured his victory. Of the 31 Senate district caucuses that voted for the new chairman, West won 22. He'd once again found himself in a position of power and influence. What would he do with it? One of his first acts was to appoint Walter West, he of the screwball bottle, the new sergeant-at-arms. Alan West's election was met by blank stares from many Republican office holders. No statement of congratulations came from the governor. Silence from other elected officials was palpable, but the silence was one-sided. Early on, it became clear that West was not afraid to speak out in a manner likely to garner resentment within the party. He appeared in an event with Shelley Luther, the rebel hair salon queen. He used her jail time resulting from defying the governor's coronavirus restrictions to springboard into a special election for a North Texas state Senate seat in a move that surely irritated both the governor and the other Republicans in Luther's race, including the respected state representative Drew Springer. West quickly steered the GOP into unnecessary controversy regarding his adoption of a motto for the party, "We Are the Storm." It's also used by followers of the QAnon conspiracy theory. Phrase comes from a popular meme, the kind of thing you see on a bumper sticker of a truck with Punisher decals. Goes something like this: "Fate whispered to the warrior, 'You cannot withstand the storm.' The warrior replied, 'I am the storm.'" West has described the quote as a reference to Psalm 29, which talks about the voice of God being heard through a storm. QAnon believers are waiting for a storm of their own. He arrested the leaders of a non-existent global cabal of pedophiles. West's use of the phrase and his directive that the party use it to is written up in the New York Times as an example of Republican leadership flirting with QAnon. West first lashed the paper for not talking it over with him, and then, when the Times reached out for a follow-up, issued a statement in which he wrote that it was offensive and condescending that white, liberal, progressive socialists would expect me to respond to their demand to know how long I had said something. Here's a pure example of the leftist embrace of racism. It is obvious that as a strong conservative black man, I'm not allowed to think or speak. In this case and others, Texas GOP communications took a decidedly strange turn. In August, shortly after West was elected, a video appeared on the party's YouTube channel with no explanation or context. The video intercut footage of Biden quoting the Prophet Muhammad with Urdu subtitles, with footage taken from a voting drive for young Muslims. Video seemed to imply either that Biden was a Muslim or that Biden was empowering a Muslim takeover of the United States. This would be in line with West's long-standing public position that the United States is locked in a 1,400-year struggle against Islam. It would have been shocking to see the party itself promoting this kind of nonsense just a few years back, but now the most shocking thing about the video is that West isn't in it. Most of the other videos over the past few months have been poorly shot, usually unedited recordings of West on the road. On July 31st, the Texas GOP YouTube channel posted a video of West in a sweaty tank top during a jog in El Paso, with Mexico visible over his shoulder. Wind whips by the mic, and some of the sound is barely audible. Other videos show West occasionally in a form-fitting exercise shirt at various locations, the Republican National Convention or on a ranch in Kerrville. It all gives the impression that the Republican Party of Texas has become, well, a vehicle for the promotion of Alan West. But nothing so far has characterized West's tenure as much as the sparring with Governor Abbott, which seems to intensify as Texas moved toward Election Day. at the rally at the governor's mansion, West theatrically delivered a resolution passed by a state Republican executive committee demanding an end to pandemic restrictions. West is echoing a real demand from the base to stand up to Abbott, but it's notable that apart from Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller, who also attended the rally, no other Republican statewide officials are joining West's crusade. Even Dan Patrick, who was once spoken of a potential future primary challenger to Abbott, has focused most of his fire elsewhere. But the leader of their party seems hell-bent on breaking Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, "Thou shalt not speak ill of any fellow Republican." It's hard not to wonder, is West running for something? As the election got closer, West's eccentric activities continued. At a rally in McAllen, he spoke through a megaphone branded with the logo of InfoWars, Austin conspiracy theorist Alex Jones's site. In North Texas, he endorsed a candidate running for a seat on the board of the Grapevine-Colleyville Independent School District, an unusual matter for a state party chair to involve himself in. West was spurred by the fact that the candidate, Tommy Snyder, opposed the existence of a student Marxist club at Grapevine High School, and he took jabs at the media. When a reporter with the Texas Tribune asked the state party for comment on footage of a Trump supporter ramming a vehicle in a Biden campaign caravan traveling on I-35, West responded with a pointed attack. "Prepare to lose. Stop bothering me." His statement read, "Maybe Soros can cut y'all another check in 2022. During early voting, it became apparent that some ballots in Tarrant County had been printed with erroneous barcodes, which meant that they would have to be counted by hand rather than by machine. The GOP needed poll watchers to attend the count, a function that might in the past have fallen to the state party. Instead, Abbott asked former chair James Dickey to take care of it. West had become kind of a chaos agent in the GOP, but would he help or hurt Republican candidates? If they did poorly in the election, West would make a good scapegoat. If they did well, West would want his share of the credit. On November 1st, a new West video was posted to the party's YouTube account. In the video, titled "Report from the Rio Grande Valley," West stands by the river in Eagle Pass wearing jeans and a crisp white polo with "We Are the Storm" printed over his left breast. He describes his tour up through the Rio Grande Valley from Harlingen to Laredo and towns further north. Eagle Pass is a couple hundred miles upriver from what Texans regard as the valley. "The Hispanic community is waking up. The valley is waking up," he said. "It used to be this deep blue area, but they're starting to understand their principles and values because we've engaged. We have talked to them." On election night, the Republican Party of Texas stopped Democrats cold. Texas Democrats failed to take the state house, went bust on their bid to win several congressional seats, and watched as Trump won the state by a respectable 6 percentage points. But perhaps the most shocking story involved the impressive showing the GOP made in South Texas. In heavily Hispanic counties along the border, Trump dramatically outperformed his 2016 margin. In Cameron County, where Brownsville is located, Trump lost in 2016 by 33 percentage points. In 2020, he closed the gap to 13, and in the case of rural Zapata County south of Laredo, Trump went from a 33-point loss to a 5-point win over Biden. It was a stunning shift of political momentum that karate chopped Texas Democrats in their soft underbelly. The day after the election, West appeared in a new video in front of the Texas Capitol. He asked each of the 5.8 million Texans who voted for Trump to send the party $5, a bill with Lincoln on it. Party needed a war chest. "One of the things I want to make sure that we do with the Republican Party of Texas is that we don't just ramp up for an election and then ramp back down," he said. The party, his party, needed to maintain a constant, steady state. Allen's army wasn't going to rest. And that conveniently brings us, a little short admittedly, but still, to the end of our reading for today. Been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2 on Sight into Sound Broadcasting, your print information source.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
Between the darkness on the street and the houses filling up with light, between the stillness in my heart and the roar of the approaching night, somebody's calling after somebody. Somebody turns a corner out of sight, looking for somebody. Somewhere in the night. expected and the way it's always been. I can't walk back in again after the way we fight. Just outside, there are people laughing, living lives we used to lead, chasing down the love they need. Somewhere in the night, tender is the night, and the benediction of the neon light. Tender, tender are the hunters, tender is the night.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 63 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the December issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with this article, Searching for the West Side Sound. 60 years ago, San Antonio teenagers invented a style that thrives to this day, by Joe Nick Potoski. Texas music is known for its sense of place, whether it's Western swing, guitar-powered electric blues, or Dirty South hip-hop. but at least one Texas city, and one specific part of that city, can claim a sound all its own, the West Side Sound of San Antonio. The West Side Sound refers to a specific place and time, beginning in the 1950s, when Mexican-American teenagers in San Antonio first heard rock and roll. Budding musicians from across the city formed bands playing music that incorporated rhythm and blues, often with a heavy horn section, and influences of swing, conjunto, and country. Sometimes referred to as Chicano soul, the music drew on the early rock and rollers from New Orleans, like Fats Domino, and emphasized slow dance standards known as belly rubbers. But unlike scenes in other places, the West Side Sound never completely went away. Its popularity persists thanks to veteran San Antonio musicians and fans championing their city's native sound. You can hear the influence of the West Side Sound in songs like "Hey Baby, Que Paso" by enduring San Antonio keyboardist Augie Myers, and in the music of younger musicians such as Los Texmaniacs, Garrett T. Capps, Mitch Webb and the Swindles, Adrian Quesada, and Johnny Benavides. One of the local fans keeping the West Side Sound alive is Chris Verlas, a retired firefighter who operates the NoHitNetwork.com website and KCJV 97.9, a low-power FM radio station based in Leon Valley in northwest San Antonio. Featuring non-charting regional releases from the 1950s through the 70s, or the greatest sounds you've never heard of, the station plays a whole lot of West Side Sound records. "The West Side Sound is to San Antonio what Motown is to Detroit," Varelis says. "The sound is unique and immediately identifiable. It's really hard to convey the impact of a few local high school teenagers who decided to sing and dream." In the 1950s, San Antonio was far enough out of the mainstream, geographically and culturally, to foster a scene from local radio stations playing records by local bands. Only a few of those recordings, notably "Talk to Me" by Sonny and the Sunliners and "She's About a Mover" by the Sir Douglas Quintet, made it onto the national charts. Still, radio airplay and jukebox spins made regional stars out of groups such as Rudy and the Reno Bops, the Royal Jesters, the Dell Kings, Sonny Ace y Los Twisters, the Dreamliners, the Commands, the Marques, and Charlie and the Jives. Arturo "Sauce" Gonzalez was an early member of Sonny and the Sunliners in 1962. He later played Hammond B3 organ with the late Doug Shom, and today he leads Sauce Gonzalez and the West Side Sound. "My band is called the West Side Sound, and even I have a hard time explaining it," he jokes. But, he says, a hallmark of the sound is its simplicity. "We used to play R&B tunes by Fats Domino, Little Richard, Smiley Lewis, B.B. King, Little Willie John, and lots of other black artists," he says. "We Chicanos from the West Side would rearrange the music for two tenor saxophones and a piano, and it was very important to play the triplets. Playing them by ear rather than reading charts was the West Side Sound, too." The West Side Sound didn't really exist as a moniker until 1983, long after the music's heyday. That's when Somm, a San Antonio-born musical prodigy who made his mark on the sound with the Sir Douglas Quintet, released an album with Myers titled "The West Side Sound Rolls Again." "That's the first mention," Jason Longoria says, pointing to the cover of the album in the music room of his San Antonio home. No one knew what to call it until then. Longoria, 42, is another local keeping the West Side Sound alive through collecting records and sharing his research with the world. "The musicians came from all over San Antonio," he adds, "but the West Side is the heart." San Antonio's West Side, the oldest urban Mexican-American neighborhood in Texas, is the historic hub of the city's Hispanic culture. After World War II, two record labels, Rio Records and Corona Records, showcased the music of the working-class neighborhood. Corona recorded traditional Spanish music ensembles. Rhea Records issued records by young Mexican-Americans playing all kinds of sounds. Rhea Records was to San Antonio what Sun Records was to Memphis, Longoria says. All these people had an opportunity to make a record. Rhea Records owner Jaime Wolf would record anyone who came in, press up copies, and service jukebox distributors and radio stations with copies. He didn't dictate what people should sing or play. Longoria collects recordings and ephemera documenting the era. He has also sought out old performers and even gotten a few of them back on stage, including Rudy T. Gonzalez, the lead singer from Rudy and the Reno Bops, and Little Sammy J. Jaramillo, featured for vocalist from the storied Tiffany Lounge Club. Longoria, who works at HEB's corporate headquarters for his day job, developed his obsession through his parents' love of the Texas Tornadoes, the 1990s Tex-Mex supergroup consisting of Somm, Myers, Freddie Fender, and Flaco Jimenez, all pioneers of the sound. When that first album came out, my parents would tell me about Doug Somm and all the guys coming from around here, Longoria says. Doug Somm stuck with me because he was local, very eclectic, and played a mixed bag of stuff that I related to. Longoria's research traces the origins of the West Side sound to the merging of two bands, Conjunto San Antonio, Alegre, and Conjunto Mexico, which joined forces as Mondo and the Chili Peppers in 1955. As the players traded their bajo sextos and accordions for electric guitars, their music transitioned from polkas and rancheras to rock and roll and Louisiana blues. They were also hearing music from local black blues musicians, a scene with 1940s roots in the Keyhole Club, which advertised itself as, quote, the first integrated nightclub in the South. Mondo and the Chili Peppers toured around the country, playing cities like Las Vegas, Denver, New York, and Philadelphia, where they appeared on the popular American Bandstand TV show. Back in San Antonio, the band had its own television show on KCOR, first with Spanish-speaking MCs, and then with Scratch Phillips, a black disc jockey. On the road with rock and roll, the band's 1957 debut album improbably fused country, conjunto, R&B, and triplet-powered rock and roll. The playlist incorporated songs from Ernest Tubbs' I'm Walkin' the Floor Over You to the popular standard South of the Border, to San Antonio Rose by Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. San Antonio has got its own version of pretty much all of American music, Longoria says. And it's got music that no other place can claim. Finding the West Side Sound. On the radio, DJ Chris Veralis plays West Side Sound bands on his station, 97.9 FM in San Antonio, and online at nohitnetwork.com. Legendary San Antonio DJ Henry Pepsi Pina hosts the San Antonio Oldies Show Sundays, 6 to 9 p.m. on Radio Jalapeno, KEDA 1540 AM, 102.3 FM, and saoldies.com. In the clubs, see live performances by West Side Sound bands, including Sauce Gonzalez and the West Side Sound, the West Side Horns, Joe Jama, Frank Rodarte, Al Gomez, Little Henry, Chinte Montez, Jack Barber, and Urban Urbano at venues including the Squeeze Box, Sacho's, and the Lighthouse Lounge. On TV, hear strains of the West Side Sound on Jimmy Kimmel Live. Cleto Escobedo III leads the house band, which includes his father, Cleto Escobedo Jr., a saxophonist and founding member of San Antonio's Del Kings. In the shops, find West Side Sound recordings at Janie's Record Shop, 1012 Bandera Road, and Del Bravo Record Shop, 554 Enrique